This is starting to sound like a bad comic book plot.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and the last time that we were with you, we were with today's guest host, and I had such a good time that I haven't recorded a podcast since. So, you know who I'm talking about. Stand and state your name, special guest host.
I am Adam Chapman of the Comic Shenanigans Podcast.
Awesome. Nice to have you back, Adam. I hope your trip to Disney was fantastic. Are you ready to talk about some Spider-Man shenanigans?
I am always ready to talk about Spider-Man, especially when it's the Clone Saga. It's a big, big thing for me.
Awesome. So I guess we should begin. The Clone Saga, did you read it while it was coming out?
Pieces of it. I remember I got a comic as a present in 1993, I want to say, or 94. I think it's 94. I got Amazing Spider-Man 396. This is Back from the Edge, part 3 of 4. I remember I got that. It was probably my birthday or something. I just loved it. It was such an awesome issue. It was that first time, I think, that I ever actually saw Daredevil on the page, although it was his 90s kind of armor costume, which is why I love that costume, which is why when I got married, the gift that my groomsmen and everyone at my bachelor party got me was the Daredevil statue in that costume, because that's the kind of that's the Daredevil I think of, even though it's not necessarily the best Daredevil. So I got this issue. It was Back from the Edge, part 3 of 4. I absolutely loved it. It actually made me go out to the newsstand back when comics were actually on those and pick up the issue of Spectacular Spider-Man. I think it was, I think 219. Which was part 4 of the storyline, and then that was kind of it. Like, I didn't really read anything else in the Clone Saga for a little while, but then when I went, there's this kid I went to school with, I think in grade 7, who was buying throughout the middle of the Clone Saga, kind of showing me that and they're really, trying to get me excited and trying to, care about this stuff. So then I kind of remember some of the Ben Reilly period, really kind of reading it through him, kind of reading about the Great Game and all sorts of weird stuff that happened in the Spider books at the time. And then I remember when Revelations came out, the ending storyline, I picked up the 4th issue right off the newsstand, and it absolutely floored me. And I started buying Spider-Man comics regularly the next month, which is ironic that it's the minute Ben Reilly left. I had a fondness for this era. Once I started getting a little bit of money, I would go back and try to buy back issues. So a year or two later, I was buying tons of the Clone Saga back issues because I was just so entranced with the entire storyline. I thought it was so cool, and I didn't have it all, which actually made it all the more cooler. So I'd be reading letters pages, talking about other things, and what people thought was really going on, and I was so enthralled. So that's kind of my personal experience. And then when they first started putting out the Clone Saga in trade paperbacks, I was like, no way, is this actually happening? Do I have to pinch myself? So I remember every new volume coming out, just getting the pre-orders and just with bated breath being able to read it all over again, experience the highs and the lows, and really get to appreciate the entire thing. So I have not just the 5 Clone Saga epics, I have the 6 Ben Reilly epics, also the original Clone Saga kind of proto-epic in terms of its size. So I've hunkered down hard in terms of the Clone Saga. I love the material, love the period. There's a few other comics in there I probably bought that I really liked as well, like Amazing Spider-Man 407, which was the first Ben Reilly as Spider-Man starring issue of Amazing Spider-Man. I also picked up off newsstand that these memories are coming back to me. I bought Sensational Spider-Man 0 right off the stands at a comic book store. I was there for a funny reason. I had a few issues with Untold Tales of Spider-Man. They got stolen from my locker at school. My mom said, well, I'll rebuy them for you. Here's some money. And then instead of buying them, I bought Sensational Spider-Man 0 and something else. So, but it's a great comic, and I still love it to this day. That's a long, long preamble.
No, that's good. That's what I'm looking for, man. Because you know what? I was going to talk about this by myself because I said, I don't know if anyone's going to want to talk about the Clone Saga with me. I knew you did, but sometimes scheduling could be difficult. So I said, I got to talk about this in some capacity. But I'm happy that you're here, and I want to hear your input because you've experienced the whole thing. I got to say, editor's note, I read the first two trades a couple of years ago, and I was so jaded by public opinion of the Clone Saga that I kind of dismissed it and just quit trying to get through the whole thing, because everything you hear about the Clone Saga is what the effect that it had on the comics industry and how it's, you know, that typical 90s thing that went wrong. And so I'm like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't invest in getting all of these after all. But I actually rebought the first two trades the day that we went to the baseball game and we recorded our last podcast. I bought them. Since then, I've read the first three volumes with a fresh perspective, not remembering anything that I had read in the past, not worrying about any of the criticisms that it gets, because I love Spider-Man. In the last couple of years, I love Spider-Man more and more and more. And I started reading maybe it's the way it's presented, the way it's put together in the fashion within the collections that makes it a little bit more, you can kind of decipher what's going on in order. And I don't know when The Lost Years was originally published, but having that be one of the first things you read after the flip book aspects of those initial Amazing Spider-Man, Spectacular Spider-Man stories, it fits in perfectly. So you have some sort of an investment in the Ben Reilly character before Power and Responsibility starts. And I know we might be talking about things that people who haven't read the Clone Saga yet really understand, but I think it gets a bit of a bad rap. But again, I haven't read everything yet, and I know that the beginning of it's really good, but then it takes a bit of a detour into I don't know what the proper word would be, but maybe a slog of a reading fest. So far I've read up to volume 3 of the Clone Saga epic. I've read the original Clone Saga from Jerry Conway, so I know the premise and the history behind it. And I gotta say, like, the first little bit of this series is really intriguing. I think it gets a poor rap because it's wrapped up in the Clone Saga curtain, like it's all under one umbrella. But when you see it from the miniseries, the four-part miniseries that they are at a time, I think it's a very different reading experience. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It's interesting because I have a different feeling on it, because it's interesting for me to hear you talk about it, because I'm someone who, you know, experienced parts of it when it occurred. I actually picked up Lost Years when it actually happened. These fragments of my memory are coming to me. I remember I was visiting a family friend, and we were in upstate New York, and not even New York, I think we're just in Buffalo, and I remember being at, like, a grocery store and picking up Lost Years number 1 and then seeking out 2 and 3. So, like, I experienced some of that when it was kind of happening. So for me, I kind of hate the presentation of this because it's out of order. It doesn't work for me. I think that it works differently. I think it works better for a new reader to kind of experience it, but I think it also takes away a little bit of the surprise and there's a lot of twists and turns the overall storyline takes, and I feel like having Lost Years at the beginning of the collection, although, as you said, it kind of is a nice natural transition for that character, it also kind of ruins some of the punch that comes up later. Mm-hmm. Back to, like, as you said, you have the flip books originally, which were part of the Power and Responsibility storyline around the other side of the issue, and they kind of have the birth of the clone and kind of understanding the clone's perspective, which is very interesting. But then you have, again, stuff that was published much later, like 6 or 7 months later, you have the whole story of, you know, what is it like when Ben Reilly kind of realizes what has happened to him, which is illustrated by John Romita Jr., which is kind of an unofficial prequel to Lost Years, because it kind of sets up that whole idea. It feels out of place for me. It feels like it's not in the right spot. But I'm a weird, weird chronology purist. In terms of how these stories happen in actual comic book time, it makes sense, but I just think it loses something in the retelling.
Yeah, I think you're right from a certain perspective, because the within The Lost Years, the entire plot is spoiled in certain caption boxes where Kane gives away a lot of information that you're supposed to keep in suspense.
Even the whole question of who Kane is. Kane was a giant question mark up until the trial of Peter Parker, and here it's just kind of spoiled.
Right, and I think I think that's why reading it now for me, I'm like, you like it regardless because you read it in a certain way. You have the nostalgia for it. You enjoyed it for what it was. I'm reading it now, and I'm also listening to a podcast that's the Clone Saga Chronicles, and they're reading it in the way things were published. And they're all kind of fans of the Clone Saga, but at the same time, they're trying to fairly criticize it. And a part of me is saying, you know, I think people look back at comics in the 90s unfairly because of where they went in the late 90s and early 2000s. We forget that there was a time when this was catered to 12, 13-year-olds. Like, I was a 10-year-old when ASM 400 came out, and it was extremely exciting. Me and a friend, a schoolmate of mine, were going to the newsstand every week seeing if it was coming out. And you read comics. They were written and drawn and presented in a very different way in the early 90s. And for that time, if you kind of transport your mind when you read, you know, The Death of Superman or Nightfall or The Clone Saga or even Age of Apocalypse and read it for when it was, put it in that lens, that scope, this is pretty fun stuff, all things considered. And considering how much Spider-Man was proliferated at that time, like there's five titles that are being published, it was a difficult thing to make cohesive. And the way that they tried to do it here, I thought kind of worked when you split up the four books into sections of two, and you have the Scarlet Spider in Web of Spider-Man and Adjectiveless Spider-Man, and then you've got ASM and Spectacular telling the story of Peter Parker. I thought that was clever. I like that approach.
Sure. It didn't last long, obviously, but it lasted long enough to, again, give both characters and books kind of their own identity. And
yeah.
Even the idea that, you know, one was called like Web of Life and Web of Death, like it's a very clear contrast, and I really like that.
Did you like the idea that Terry Cavanaugh, who wrote Web of Spider-Man, he was writing? Terry Cavanaugh?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess before, as we continue, we should say that the writing team here was a pretty solid group of guys. You had J.M. DeMatteis on Amazing Spider-Man, who arguably has written some of the best Spider-Man stories of all time. Think of Kraven Last Hunt, The Child Within, Spider-Man, ASM 400. Then you got Tom DeFalco, who jumped on to Spectacular Spider-Man because it didn't have a regular writer at the time. And he was pretty excited for how excited the team was, the editorial group was, for this Clone Saga idea that he came on. And you got Sal Buscema teaming up with Tom DeFalco and Mark Bagley with J.M. DeMatteis and Howard Mackey on Spider-Man and then Terry Cavanaugh. Like, this is a pretty fun time to be reading Spider-Man. And they're good writers for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it was an era where everything was being deconstructed. Like, every hero was being replaced at some point in the 90s. Thor was replaced by Eric Masterson. Superman had four replacements. Batman had a replacement. Wonder Woman had a replacement. Green Lantern, Green Arrow. Like, this was just what was happening. Did you like the concept of making Peter Parker the clone and Ben Reilly the real version? And kind of, did you feel it was a cheat to do this? And kind of, it didn't erase what happened to Peter, but I feel like it kind of does when you've been invested in all this history for 20 plus years, 200 issues, if not more at that point in time, of this Peter who wasn't the real Peter the whole time. Did you like that they were trying to reinvigorate the original, what's the word, that essence of Peter back into the book?
I mean, that's an exceptionally complicated question because, I mean, really, I mean, if you come at it from the standpoint of creative and editorial, I mean, they would look for ways to make a situation where you would have a single Spider-Man again. And this was one of their ways of doing that, right? I mean, this is a way of, you know, Peter could still be married to MJ, but what if we now have a different Spider-Man, but he's actually, you know, the original guy? It's not the worst idea, because it's not like it's a different person being Spider-Man. The core idea that what is Spider-Man and that core idea of responsibility and what happened to Uncle Ben is still present in this character's life. It just kind of goes in a different direction. You mentioned the fact that there's a lot of different replacements at that time. Marvel had, you know, had kind of a long history of this at this point. I mean, you had a replacement Iron Man in Jim Rhodes, who years and years and years and years later would become War Machine. Like, War Machine, you know, happened around, what, issue 280 of Iron Man, but he was first Iron Man in, like, the 180s. So, like, you know, a long time previous, he had actually supplanted, taken over for Tony Stark for years, while Tony Stark was a Stark raving drunk, no pun intended. So, you look at Captain America, you know, they had taken away Steve Rogers for a while, put on Walker, and then eventually brought back Steve Rogers, but they spun off Walker in his own thing. You had the same thing happening with Thor. You had Eric Masterson taking over, and then him spinning over and over being Thunderstrike. So you had Thunderstrike, War Machine, and U.S. Agent. So you had all the core Avengers and their spinoffs. So then you kind of had the idea that you could do that with Spider-Man. Like, what if you had this character? The fact that they ended up really going for it and saying, you know, the Peter you all know and love is a clone and we're going to replace him was problematic more because, not because it was necessarily a bad idea, but at the end of the day, when you ask someone who Spider-Man is, they're never going to say Ben Reilly. They're always going to say Peter Parker. It's kind of like why they eventually got rid of the Linda Danvers version of, Supergirl, Peter David, written in the late 90s, because at the end of the day, if you ask someone who Supergirl is, she's not, you know, a weird angel entity. She's not a protoplasmic matrix from another pocket universe. She's Superman's cousin. So we got that back in 2004 when Jeff Loeb reintroduced us to Supergirl being his cousin, Kara Zor-El, and we haven't lost that since. So it's been 14 years, and now it's firmly entrenched. We're never going back to a non- you know, Superman's cousin, Supergirl. So there's kind of core ideas of these characters. So at the end of the day, Peter Parker is Spider-Man. So they were never not going to have that. So I think that was the problem. If they had just given Ben Reilly the identity and figured out a way messily to get rid of the Peter Parker we knew, it probably would have worked out somewhat better, and they may not have had the same pullback because it just felt weird that you had a guy not named Peter Parker as Spider-Man.
Yeah, and that I agree with 100%. And I really like the fact that even though one of them is the clone, like Ben Reilly being the clone, I loved it. I really understood the value of this story in the scope of me having read during these last couple of this last month or two a lot of J.M. DeMatteis stuff, because he is very much. All writers are, but he's so much more invested in breaking down the psychology of characters, and he's almost obsessed with identity. A lot of his books deal with the identity crisis of a character. So I felt like reading this, that's another reason why I was heavily invested in it, because this is a big chunk of his career, because I'm about to talk to him. And I said, you know what? This is a good excuse for me to read the Clone Saga, because I wasn't planning on it. But it's not a detour of what I'm trying to prepare for. And I love the struggle of Peter Parker, Spider-Man, hating his life and wanting to just run away and almost be a vagabond in a way, just completely envelop himself in being the spider. And then you've got this other guy who has no identity and so desires Peter's life. So they meet at this crossroads where they want what the other has. It's like looking in the mirror of who you are and what you want and what you don't, not appreciating what you may have. So I love that story aspect of it. And of course, it's catered to, you know, children's reading level at the same time, because it is early, you know, mid-90s comic books, and it's still being featured on the newsstand, but there is a lot of depth to it, I found. Maybe I'm just reaching for it, but I thought that was really intriguing.
Yeah, I don't think you're reaching at all. And so I'm looking at my copy of the Clone Saga Epic Volume 1, and one of the backups from the month Aunt May died was, again, the story of, you know, Ben Reilly and after he leaves New York. And one of the most unsettling but really, really gripping stories in that kind of those few backups, is the story of, you know, Ben Reilly ends up at a bar and we see him super drunk, and that's super unsettling, because Peter Parker is typically portrayed as a character who does not drink. So now you see a guy who's already dealing with, you know, the loss of his identity, which is hugely shattering. He's drunk off his gourd, and now he's, you know, he's getting angry. He's, you know, he's throwing things around. He, you know, almost breaks someone's wrist. Like, he's just out of control, and it's terrifying. And this is a 90s comic. Kids are reading it. I'm reading it around this period, and this is really kind of really dark and human stuff. And then you even have a shot where a man is about to kill himself with a gun in his mouth. Like, that's not what you expect to see on a newsstand. So it definitely plays at a darker, deeper level. It's such a interesting story to see a version of Peter pushed to such a degree that, you know, he kind of becomes the villain in the story. And then, yeah, he kind of saves the guy's life, but he kind of put him in danger in the first place. It's a really harrowing read, and it's very short. It's not a very long story, but you got a lot of emotional wallop there.
Which issue is that?
Well, I couldn't tell you exactly because it's not telling us what issue it's reprinted from. It's the Parker Legacy Part 3. So I'm going to say that was Spectacular Spider-Man 223. That's just a guess.
So is that like the front of the original, volume one of the Clone Saga epic?
It's in the first little bit. It's the last story before the Lost Years takes over.
Okay, got you. Yeah. And maybe that's why, like, I found myself just flipping through it and thinking, like, why? I'm supposed to not like this. I'm supposed to know what good Spider-Man comics are, and this is, like, you know, the dark stain on the Spider-Man legacy. And that's why I actually posted on Facebook, I'm like, I'm reading the Clone Saga epic, and I'm really enjoying this stuff. Am I crazy? And Kevin Boyd was like, you might be. But I'm like, no, this is good stuff from good writers. Like, DeFalco and DeMatteis, I could read their Spider-Man all the time. Do you think that Spider-Man had become – people were saying, oh, we lost what Spider-Man was. He, you know, we grew up. And we made Peter have a mortgage and have a marriage and this, and that's not what Spider-Man was. And I kind of disagree with that viewpoint. Not that the original Spider-Man isn't that young, Parker luck, kind of figuring life out, never having the luck with the girls, but getting the pretty girl. Like, at the same time, I like the fact that you were kind of growing with Peter in some way, real time. It wasn't – it's comic book time, but – this was a guy who did go to college. So it was a guy who did get married. Things, you know, he went through ebbs and flows of life just like all of us did. So now he married the beautiful supermodel, but now he's in a depression. And I kind of like that with Peter Parker, you go through those different eras. Even with Dan Slott, you went through, you know, the Brand New Day, big time worldwide, where now Peter's a billionaire and now he's back to his square. I like that aspect of Peter that you experience life in it through his eyes. Did you think he was too dark during that time, that he needed to go back to that good old Peter Parker?
Well, that so-called darkness was obviously by design. Like, they wanted to, I think that was part of the idea there too, is to show, you know, what is Spider-Man? He's the guy who's resilient. And if you have this version of Peter kind of breaking down and kind of losing himself, and you have this other guy who by all rights should have lost himself, but still has that spark, that we're used to seeing in Peter, that maybe our Peter isn't the real one because of that. So they were playing into that. So it's not like they just happened to accidentally make Peter super dark one day. Like, this was by design. This is where they were going in terms of building up to what the Clone Saga was going to be. Like, they had lead time. They knew what they were doing. So in terms of kind of seeing the character become a little darker, plus they had put the character through the ringer in the previous year. Like, you can't just bring back his parents, reveal them to not really be his parents, have him go on a crazy pursuit, the name of the storyline, of Chameleon, have him almost kill the Chameleon because of, you know, how he's been pushed to the edge, which is in keeping with the character because he almost killed Green Goblin back in the day when he killed Gwen, so it's not like it's that far afield. And then to find out that the person who orchestrated it is his recently departed best friend, Harry Osborn, kind of cracks the guy. So they were playing the character. character into a certain direction to kind of break them so that they could do this storyline. So we're kind of reading it in a bubble here where
yeah.
you just kind of start and Spider-Man's already, you know, wanting to be the Spider. He's withdrawn and he's not really talking to MJ and he's kind of just isolating himself. But there was lead up in the months previous. You had storylines pushing him in this direction. There's a storyline called The Shrieking and Amazing Spider-Man that happened. Even over in Spectacular, there's two issues where he fought the Scorpion. I actually talked about that on a different podcast, the Untold Tales of Spider-Man podcast a few months ago. So there was a lot of stuff happening that kind of pushed him in this direction. So it's you're at a bit of a disadvantage because you don't come into it kind of knowing that. And kind of knowing all the different stuff that he's been dealing with, you're just kind of given a Peter Parker who's kind of unhinged. So you're kind of at a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. So for you, in these first three volumes of the Clone Saga, because like you said, it's really an 11-volume epic. And we always like go back and forth about, you know, what you have to read and what I'm not going to read, et cetera, et cetera. But in these first three volumes, I think it ends at issue ASM 401. And I'm trying to think of that last arc where – what it was called, where
– Mark of Cain.
What's it – what was it?
The Mark of Cain.
The Mark of Cain. That's where Peter and Ben switch places in prison?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in those first three volumes – what are some of your favorite moments, or what do you consider the highlights to be, and maybe at the same time the lowlights?
That's a tough one because there's a lot in here.
It's a lot of comics. It's a lot, and to think that it continues that much longer, you can see where things get off the rails.
I will admit, as the Clone Sagas went further on, the volumes got shorter.
Okay.
If you look at the first three volumes of the Amazing Spider-Man, the Clone Saga Epic, those three volumes are pretty thick. All of the remaining volumes are all thinner than this, particularly the Ben Reilly ones. So I feel like the Ben Reilly ones could have just been five, maybe even four, but they definitely just made them shorter volumes and charged about the same.
Right.
So in terms of my favorite stuff or some of the best stuff, so I guess – I'm going to kind of go through it just in terms of presentation order. I like the story that sets up what happened to the clone from the clone's perspective leading up to and right after Amazing Spider-Man 149. I think that's a really interesting perspective. I really also like the image of Peter and MJ kind of embracing in the doorway after Peter Parker thinks that he's not the clone because he actually loves MJ. It's a different kind of slant on that image because this is a weird divergence, but not really in some ways. There's always been a question of when did Spider-Man lose his virginity?
right.
Some people think it's Amazing Spider-Man 149, which this image of them kind of kissing passionately in the doorway kind of is a prelude to that. And so, because in that comic, he just kind of goes in and you shut the door and it's kind of left to your imagination what happens. So some people think that that's when him and MJ first slept together. Other people think that he never slept with Gwen. And there's a part of Gwen, since past, which always pissed me off because it kind of intimated that he never slept with Gwen, which I always thought was wrong. I always liked the idea that him and Gwen were together. Other people will think that, he had to have lost his virginity before the Black Cat because she couldn't have been the first one, but they definitely were sleeping together. And then there's other people who read the honeymoon issue of Spectacular Spider-Man and kind of say, well, you can see how he's very uncomfortable going on the honeymoon. And then when they leave their honeymoon, he's all, cocky and swagger. And people are thinking, now he slept with her and now he feels better about himself, but he was uncomfortable before. So it's a weird divergence. But, when did Spider-Man first lose his virginity? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, you know what? I kind of agree with you that it's heavily suggested that at the end of 149, when he goes to see MJ after the whole original clone saga, you see that he's officially moved on. And he says something in that panel where he's like, I'll show you just how much I love you, or like, let me in, something to that effect, where it's not provocative, but it's very suggestive.
But but like lightly suggestive, because again, it's the 1970s.
Right.
It can be taken many different ways, but it doesn't feel crude. It feels very, it could be totally G or it could be rated R. Like, it could really be either way.
Exactly. And that's why I feel like that's probably the moment where it happened. It makes sense. Because
sleeping with MJ or him losing his virginity in its entirety? Like, do you think that's when he sleeps with anybody, or that's when he sleeps with MJ the first time?
I kind of find it hard to believe that, you know, as a college student with Gwen, that it never happened. That's kind of weird because he's just so Peter's affection and love for her is so intimate in a way that you almost feel like they had to, right?
Or maybe just very pure, like or like that first love, but not necessarily the first carnal love.
True, there's that too. So I definitely feel that at the end of 149, when he goes into her apartment, something's happening.
Okay. Now I can honestly say, when we sat down today, did not think I'd be talking about Peter Parker's sex life.
Me neither.
I mean, that being said, I was recently on a podcast where I talk about the sexualization of Spider-Man comics, so it's not necessarily a big surprise that I would do this.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at the exact panel on it's in the original Clone Saga epic that tells you the story that Jerry Conway wrote, and literally the lines from Mary Jane says, "Do you mean that tiger for real?" And he goes, "Come here, and I'll show you." And then the door closes. And I mean, come on. I know as an innocent kid, you might not think that they're just kissing or whatever, but the door closes.
It does close.
Yeah, so something's happening behind closed doors that we're not meant to see. That the Comics Code Authority, they couldn't shut it down because the door's closed now.
Absolutely.
No,
I think that's very true.
So where were we going with this now that I think about it?
Oh, I was talking about things I liked.
Oh, okay, yeah, right. Go ahead. Keep going.
I like the storytelling, the perspective of the clone, and it's pretty well illustrated. And even that kind of the big moment of right after, you know, you see him seeing Peter with MJ and what that kind of means to him, and then his freaking out that he's the clone. Like, that's pretty dramatic. It's easy to go over the top of that, but I bought it. You know, I bought the emotional truth and sincerity of that moment. And then again, this would have been months later in comics. Publishing terms, but then you have, you know, the shock to the system where you pick up right from that story, and then you have some really great John Romita Jr. art. This is him coming back to Spider-Man and working on kind of these backups, and then doing Lost Years, and this is some of his best work of the period. It's extremely emotional. There's so much going into every panel. You feel the emotion. You feel how tense every moment is. It's Demetrius really kind of getting to the core of what this man is going through, having lost his identity. And then you go into the Lost Years, which I still think is one of my favorite Spider-Man stories, even though it's not really quote-unquote Spider-Man. He doesn't really wear a costume per se in the entire thing. Kane doesn't really wear a costume. It's very street level. It feels very intimate, the relationship between these two men who are, I mean, we know them now as two failed versions of the same man, but kind of seeing their struggle for life and finding humanity. I mean, it's interesting, especially if someone has never read 90s Kane and has only read kind of modern Kane, this is going to be very weird because, you know, the modern Kane is not that different from just a failed Peter Parker, but doesn't feel that different, whereas this is a Kane who's really much more of a monster and dealing with all the, you know, being a lifelong series of pain and agony as his body degenerates. Like, it's really something. And even the love interest they give both characters are really interesting as well. It's interesting, you know, one is a blonde, one is a redhead. Blonde is no good. The redhead's fine. It's really something. Now, eventually there would be a sequel story, which I've always found was never quite enough. It didn't really pay off the promise of the first one. But the ending was really interesting, too, when you read it when it first happened, because you didn't know what happened to Janine, but just the idea that, you know, she died somehow. Like, you got this idea that in 5 years, there was so much we didn't know, and that was exciting. And you could have done Lost Your stories forever.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like when I was reading that, especially with the John Romita art, I felt like I was reading a Spider-Man version of The Man Without Fear, where you got the character, you got the morality of the character constantly struggling with his identity and trying to figure himself out and can't help himself but to be a hero, to do the right thing because it's instinctive, but he's never wearing the costume. He kind of just, you know, puts together a you know, a quick little wrapping up his face to conceal his identity, kind of the way Daredevil does in Man Without Fear. And it's very visceral, and there's a lot of like the other characters are all, there's something about the other characters that you're not exactly sure about, but as the story progresses, a little bit of information is divulged. I liked it, and in a lot of the same ways that I liked The Man Without Fear. I'm not saying it's on the same level because, of course, Frank Miller wrote, you know, a quintessential Daredevil story that counts in real Matt Murdock's life, whereas this is this Peter, is it not Peter? But I agree. I was like, yeah, this is a great idea to tell the story of this version of a Peter Parker character who's a nomad and is Peter, has all the memories of Peter, but doesn't know who he is and is trying to figure out a way to survive. Like, that is a Peter Parker story, just trying to make it. You don't know where the next paycheck's coming from, and you've got to figure it out. That in itself is, you know, the essence of Peter Parker, even though this is a guy who's kind of scorned from his own identity, as it were.
Absolutely.
So I was like, this is a great direction. I forget that this isn't what happened, but I'm like, I want to read more of this. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead, Adam.
No, that's okay. I was moving a little bit forward. One thing I love that they've included here, and again, as I said before, I had that issue of 394 of Amazing Spider-Man, sorry, 396, I should say, and that was only, you know, two months after Power Responsibility started. So the letters pages were still reflecting the story, you know, the issues just before the Clone Saga started. And so one thing I love in this collection is you get all the different kind of Mystery Man sightings as they were seeding into the book, that this man was on his way to New York to visit Aunt May after her heart attack, to make sure he saw her before she, you know, potentially died. And I loved seeing that. And I remember the letters pages, people were correctly guessing who it was, but there was a lot of, like, who is it? And one thing, I don't know if you'll notice, but I remember reading a lot of commentary about it, is that they frequently show his hands, yep, and showing he has a class ring.
Yep.
And a lot of people are like, well, is this the clone? Maybe he isn't the clone because he's got the, you know, Peter Parker's class ring. And they prominently show it in a lot of shots. And, like, it's really cool to kind of see this character slowly getting there. And then in the issue of Spectacular, you see this version of what we think is Peter talking to May, and he looks out the window and there's Spider-Man, and you're like, holy shit, that's not who we think it is. And then it starts the Clone Saga. Like, I love that they have all those pages here, because you get to feel this building tension that someone's coming. Who is it? We already know who it is because we know what the book is, but still, you get this. You can start to feel the anticipation that someone would have felt back when this was first coming out.
Yeah, totally. I totally experienced that, even though I kind of know what, like, I know what happens. I know what gets retconned. I know, you know, at the end, ultimately, who's behind it all. But as I'm reading it, I'm like, this is great. Like, I know why people initially were invested in this. This is a lot of good stuff. This is fun. And when you see two versions of the titular character in the book, like when you read in Power and Responsibility, them teaming up, I'm like, I love this. Because I'm thinking modern day, like, they made a whole Spider-Verse where you're having every version of Spider-Man there. You've got a Miles Morales, you've got a Spider-Gwen, you've got Spider-Woman. Like, we love the Spider-Verse now, and what they, in my mind, I'm like, this is ahead of its time. It's just that what they were trying to make exit stage left was, I think, problematic, where if they, the way they were presenting it in those first couple of miniseries with, Back from the Edge and The Exile Returns, if I'm remembering the titles correctly, you're almost getting to the point where I don't care that this is the clone. I like this guy. I want him to stick around. I want there to be a Scarlet Spider and an Amazing Spider-Man. I don't have a problem with this. And if they have to interchange in each other's books or even do a team-up book, I'm totally okay with that, because one guy is more of the, like in the Ben Reilly aspect, he's more of that Peter Parker that from the 70s that you left off with, but he also has some sort of a troubled backstory in those lost years that I can't wait to read. And then you've got the Peter Parker who has been buried alive in Kraven's Last Hunt, or who has fought Venom, or, you know, dealt with the Hobgoblin. Like, I didn't want that Peter Parker to be not the real Peter Parker, but I also didn't want this Ben Reilly character to be dismissed and to wither. Like,
yeah.
I became very invested in both of them staying. Like, it didn't matter anymore because I loved them both. Like,
well, I mean, the biggest problem with the Clone Saga, as people look at it, is that it went on too long, and then and really it's marketing's problem, because marketing kept wanting to, you know, push things off. And part of it's that they finally thought they came up with a conclusion to, you know, putting Ben Reilly as Peter Parker, or sorry, as Spider-Man, but it maybe wasn't the best thought out one in terms of what are we really going to do here. And then they were kind of backed themselves into a corner that people started to kind of turn against it, or be like, you know, the minute they turned him into, you know, Ben Reilly into Spider-Man, they were behind the scenes kind of deciding, no, this is a mistake, we've got to bring Peter back. Oh, marketing wants us to keep prolonging this. So you had marketing kind of messing with what editorial was actually doing. So that's why you have, like I mentioned to you off podcast, that, you know, in the Ben Reilly epic, there's a lot of material that I would say kind of skip because it's just not fun to read and it's kind of rough. And that's the Scarlet Spider month, which is there was 2 months that between when Peter Parker left as Spider-Man and Ben Reilly was going to take over. It's supposed to happen right away. Instead, they were like, wait a minute. We did Age of Apocalypse. We canceled all the books. We did 4 months. It was awesome. It really sold well. We wanted to do that, the same thing with Spider-Man. And like, we don't want to do that. Can't we just make him Spider-Man? It's like, no. You got to have you know, a few months where it's just him as Scarlet Spider, and that's every book is going to be retitled just for those months. And it's like, can we only do it for two? And they're like, fine, you can do it for two, but you have to do it. So you have these 2 months where they threw it together. It feels thrown together. Nothing really works. It doesn't really add a lot to the overall idea of Ben Reilly. And then once you have him as Spider-Man, they create a whole new status quo, which kind of forgets those two months, I should say. So you'd have a lot of – that's what people kind of hate about the Clone Saga, is feeling that some of the mysteries went on too long, and most of it's not the writer's fault. Most of it's not even editorial's fault, per se. They were being dictated by publishing needs and – in terms of marketing, in terms of making money, and this is a period where you started to have, you know, collapse of the comic book industry. So they knew that the sales for Spider-Man were going up. So they were like, well, give them more if it's going to make us money, because other things are not selling anymore. Other things are dropping off. We have to figure something else out, but this is selling still. So this is what people don't like about the Clone Saga. And then there's a few characters that they introduce as well where, you know, they don't really live up to the hype. They also don't really fit Spider-Man's world. And eventually they kind of retcon them into something very different. So specifically I'm talking about Judas Traveler and Scryer, both characters who show up in the first storyline that launches this whole thing. They're characters who don't really have any place in the Spider-Man universe in terms of their power levels and what they're portrayed as. They end up retconning and changing it to make it a little bit more palatable right at the very end. But at the beginning, I would say, like, if you read Power and Responsibility, you're kind of like, who's this Judas Traveler guy? What is he doing here?
Yeah, no, I knew that about the Judas Traveler, that eventually he's inconsequential to the entire Spider-Man mythos. But in the beginning, I'm like, this is good. Like, I'm in for the ride. I'm here. I want to see. It's almost like I'm convincing myself, like, this is good. And then I know that there's going to be that moment in the next couple of trades where everyone's like, and this is where things got messy. Like, did you, for instance, in Volume 3, there's a whole side story of the symbiote planet written by David Michelinie and a slew of different artists for each issue that teams up Ben, Peter, and Eddie Brock going to the symbiote planet. And I thought that was a pretty cool idea. Because it was an area that hadn't been traveled yet within the Spider-Man mythos and the Venom storyline to kind of understand where the symbiote comes from. What did you think of that story? Was that the beginning of them like, okay, they're going too far with the miniseries? Because they already had the one about Doc Ock, right? I think Tom Brevoort wrote it, and I kind of liked that one where they were fighting the remainder of the Sinister Six. But did you feel like that was the start of them overdoing it?
You know what? I'm going to say yes and no, because I don't think this is really an outgrowth of Clone Saga. I just think this happens to be published at the same time. This feels, the them kind of reaching. But really, these super specials were really just glorified annuals. So it's just basically they renamed what they called the annual. Instead of having annual number 23, they have these, you know, first issues of super specials, which is, that's more, you know, obviously designed to be more about, the collector market. But really, it was just an annual, an exercise annual. I would say the flipbook story was much better than the main story.
Right.
Maybe it wasn't a flipbook, but there was just two stories involved. Now I can't remember. I think it was a flipbook, though. I did find it not very good. And it was questionable art choices and writing choices. And the one I had as a kid was the last chapter of it, which, again, is not that great. I would say it's less indicative of them going too far with the Clone Saga and more just, this is the new annual, and you got to deal with it.
And it was the era. Like, every major character had, like, Superman had five titles. Batman had five titles. The X-Men had this was just what comics were like in this time, for better or for worse. And sometimes it was for better, and a lot of times it was for worse. But all in all, like, reading The Symbiote Planet, it wasn't groundbreaking. It wasn't the best David Michelinie story, but it was fun. I enjoyed seeing them all team up. Like, just for nostalgic purposes, like, taking my critical approach to what I know comics would become, like, I can't read everything through that scope and be so harsh. I don't think it's fair to the material to look back and pick it apart, like, look at this, look at that, look at that, why did they, like, it's the era, have fun with it. And Venom was popular at the time, he was in everything. And
you're a lot closer to the storyline than I am.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't recommend and be like, you got to read this. But to have it included in the Volume 3, I'm like, hey, that's cool. I'm happy I have it in some format to read it. I may not ever read it again, but hey, whatever. It's there.
Yeah, that's pretty fair.
Yeah. The one thing I did like, and maybe I'm alone in this, is I don't have a problem with – and I know it's been changed in a lot of ways for the better, because great stories have been told with this character. But I thought it was very natural and a good send-off in how they were treating Aunt May during this time, especially to be written by J.M. DeMatteis and Tom DeFalco. I didn't feel it was hackneyed. I didn't feel it was them just trying to pull a stunt. I felt it was the right time. And bringing two Peters into it was very fitting for their reaction of what was going to happen to Aunt May in ASM 400, the build-up to it. How do you feel about this event?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's, because sometimes you could almost read it and then go, oh, yeah, it's in the Clone Saga. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really feel like it needs to be. The fact that you have Ben show up and then you have the cliffhanger of him, of Peter going to jail, like, that's kind of crazy. But other than that, like, for the most part, it's just a more emotional issue. And what I've always loved about it is that she died in a way that Peter couldn't feel any guilt about. It was old age. Her body was going to go eventually, and it finally did. And the fact that they also had her reveal that she knew that he was Spider-Man was another kind of fitting thing, which they didn't have to add, but it adds an extra layer. I like that they were able to do it in such a way that, you know, they had that afternoon together, and as opposed to being on her deathbed, which I think would have been more typical comics, more, you know, typical soap opera, kind of like when Captain Stacy died, when as he dies, he reveals that he knows that Peter is Spider-Man, but Spider-Man doesn't really get to, you know, kind of process that with him. He's just kind of left with it, whereas here you actually had him, even if it's as brief as an afternoon, you can kind of fill in the blanks that he had a moment to spend with her where she wasn't just about to die, which I think is very impactful, and it means a lot. It's an issue that almost makes me cry every time I read it, because it's intensely emotional, and in a way that it's not about something big and flashy. It says sometimes people die and they're old, and that's just what happens. And that's what makes it ring true. That's why it still works, and that's why it's upsetting that it's not really her.
And I think that's I know that's going to be adjusted as the story continues, but that's my biggest problem. And I know there's going to be more. I know there's some crappy storylines that may come up pardon?
I said that's not a Clone Saga problem. Like, the retcon takes place way after the Clone Saga ends.
But isn't that revealed when in the last Ben Reilly epic, where, or is it after that?
No. Because in fact there's an Osborne Journal one shot at the end of the Ben Reilly epics where he Norman even says in the journal that he had nothing to do with her death. He wishes he did, but he had nothing to do with Aunt May's death. It wasn't revealed until 2 years after the Clone Saga ended, when they ended all the Spider-Man books at the time with, I believe it was called The Final Chapter, where they actually revealed that, you know, Aunt May was still alive. That was not something that happened in the Clone Saga. It kind of gets tarred with the same brush, but you can read the entire Clone Saga and the Ben Reilly epics, and there's not one mention made that Aunt May's death was anything other than genuine.
Yeah, and I... What bothers me about the fact that they change it is that within the storytelling of Spider-Man 400 and all the storylines before that, I think it was what's the story called? I think it's Back from the Edge, where Peter's poisoned from the Vulture, and he has that rendezvous with Puma and what was the other character's name now? I forget.
Nocturne.
So he goes into that coma state, I think, with when Doc Ock is trying to heal Peter,
mm-hmm.
and he talks to Aunt May. He has that experience with her, and there's all this dialogue in Aunt May's subconscious where she recognizes that it's Peter's voice, that the state that she's in, and she needs to just get strong just one more time for him. To take all of that away, I feel it's such a cheat to the audience, because if she had just been in a coma and it was Peter talking to a comatose Aunt May and there's no thought balloons of her own, I wouldn't have a problem with them changing that. But because she recognizes the condition she's in and she's hanging on by the sound of his voice, to take that away, I feel is like that's sloppy. That's one of those things where I feel you can't explain it.
Yeah, but a lot of that's really, like, you know, kind of spiritual, and you can kind of read into it you wanted to. So it doesn't invalidate it for me. It doesn't ruin anything for me. You also don't know where Aunt May really is, you know, at that point, you know, what kind of condition she was in or what she was feeling. Or maybe she was in a drug-induced coma, because, like, we only know where we eventually find Aunt May, but we don't know what she was doing at this time when she was supplanted. So it could be anything.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have to ruin it for me. It is what it is, and... you know, I think it can still work. And again, a lot of it's just what Peter thinks he sees too.
That's true. I haven't read that far, and I do hope that they reprint. I know they have, but they're hard to come by now. But that the final chapter and Revelations and all of that era of Spider-Man, I hope they reprint it so I can read what actually happens to Aunt May in those stories.
They're not going to reprint that anytime soon.
Yeah, I might have to just get it digitally, but or find them in back bins. That's part of the hunt, right? The fun of it. So I have volume 4 coming in the mail anytime now. It's not in stock on Amazon, so I had to get it from like a third party, but it's coming. And I know that's where a lot of people say, like, oh my God, this is where like the maximum clonage happens, and we're just like now the toilet's swirling. What can I look forward to, or what should I be prepared for in Volume 4? Because I'm going to read up to Volume 5, definitely.
Volume 4 starts with an issue I love, with Web of Spider-Man 125, which is the first appearance of a new Green Goblin, which is very exciting at the time. I'm sure you know who it is, but at the time we had no idea who this was. It was a brand new thing, so that's pretty cool. That's, again, an issue I really liked when I was younger. And it's all about Gwen Stacy, so it's pretty cool stuff. You do get two issues, which, if you know what happens later, are going to be more bothersome for you, but you have a bit more of a focus on Traveler, with some amazing art. Story, not much. Trying to remember what else we got coming up. We have an anniversary issue of Spectacular Spider-Man. Well, not really. It's 225. It's the same month as Web of Spider-Man, and it's kind of bookending, having this new Green Goblin show up as well. Extremely, some of my least favorite Sal Buscema art. I just think the inks are too heavy.
Was he inking himself, or was it Bill Sienkiewicz that was inking him?
That is a good question. Let me just see here. It is Sienkiewicz.
Yeah, I don't know how to feel about Bill Sienkiewicz inking Buscema at that time. Like, I love the Falco and Buscema as a team, but then I'm like, this is very, I don't know. I feel like it's something, like you said, maybe too heavy.
About it's also just, you know, you have Buscema doing breakdowns, not necessarily doing full pencils.
True.
That's part of what the problem is. And then you have the finishes by Sienkiewicz, and I just don't think they meld together that well.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of a weird connection. Then you have a four-part storyline called Trial of Peter Parker, which is interesting, but the artwork really starts to vary here. I would say it's not as consistent. You have Bagley on Amazing Spider-Man, which is great, but the other books do not have as consistent a visual tone, which starts to become more and more of a noticeable problem. I would say the standouts are Tom Lyle on Spider-Man and Bagley on Amazing, but then you have, as I said, the issues with Spectacular done by Buscema. So you have a lot of kind of issues happening there. I'm going to say the Volume 3 is probably one of the weakest of the Clone, sorry, Volume 4. We're talking about 3 or 4?
4. 4.
4, okay. I would say it's probably the weakest volume of the Clone Saga epics. One thing that you're going to find irritating in the middle is that you have like a weird issue where it's all focused on just giving you quick little biographies on each character from the standpoint of, I can't even remember who it's written by. I guess by the Jackal. I don't think you're going to like that. I liked this kid a lot, but I didn't know a lot about who these characters were, and so it was a cool little one-shot, but in the middle of a book where you already know who everyone is, so this is going to be frustrating.
Probably skip it.
And introducing one of the... So flipping through this storyline reminds me of some of the things people hate most about the Clone Saga. And this is the thing. So I think in a lot of ways, and you're not going to believe me, but the worst part of the Clone Saga is going to be what you're about to wade through, and that it's because of this that people didn't want to even give Ben Reilly a shot in his own book, because his own book is actually really solid. They do some great stories with Ben Reilly when he's Spider-Man. Problem is, people had to suffer through storylines that you're about to see. So Maximum Clonage being the big one.
Is it that bad? I always wanted to read it because the covers look so cool, but is it that bad?
It's not very good. It's just not a Spider-Man story.
Got you.
I'm going to say that's the main problem here, and that you feel like at the end it's really going to set up like a status quo shift, and then it does nothing, probably, again, because of behind-the-scenes shenanigans and not because of anything to do with the writers themselves. But you have a storyline that goes from, you know, the Jackal being a very kind of typical villain. You know, he's got personal gain, you know, like originally he was really just about, you know, perfecting cloning, perfecting the woman that he's in his sick mind loved, which is Gwen Stacy, which is even more creepy now. So that's like the original version of that character. Then you have him come back and he's genetically modified his body, and you're kind of like, okay, I'll go with this. Where are you going with this? And then when you get to Maximum Clonage, it's just like, I'm going to replace the whole population with clones. And it's just like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, the storyline just starts to go a little bit crazy. There's some really cool pieces, but in terms of the actual story, it kind of goes crazy. Plus, you have a character I think you've just been introduced to in Volume 3, which is Spider-Side, or Freak Face, I think he was originally called. He was the weird, messed-up clone that they all fought at the end of Mark of Pain, I think. Am I right?
Is that the one who thought he was the real Peter Parker?
Yeah, which was really interesting when it first happened, right?
Yeah, no, listen, as I'm reading this, this is the thing. I think things are packaged as the Clone Saga, and it's like, no, this is Web of Life, part 1-4. This is Web of Death, part 1-4. They're part of an era that Ben Reilly was in the Spider-Man books, but to say this is Clone Saga, I think it's almost a bit of a misnomer. It's convenient to package it like that, because I don't look at Kraven's Last Hunt as the Dark Ages of Spider-Man. I look at it as this is that story. So I don't package everything under just like the umbrella too conveniently. I'm taking them 4-part miniseries. Some of them are better than others. Some of the Kavanaugh and Mackey stuff I like more, and some of the DeFalco, DeMatteis stuff I like more. Do you know what I mean? I don't try to...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that's a smart way to go. It is, again, like I'm not trying to ruin Volumes 4 and 5 for you, but I think those are some of the weaker ones. That's where you have the storyline kind of going a little bit more off the rails. in terms of all the different things they could be doing. The art becomes a little bit, you know, less on point. In volume 5, this is how late you're going to get it. You're going to get the other half of those flip books with the Planet of the Symbiotes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you're going to get, like, much later, which introduces, like, a new version of the lizard. So you're going to get, whole new stuff there. I would say, again, volume four is a little rough. Volume 5, the back half, is super strong. You get a better sense of what they want to do. Again, not always the greatest art, but you get a better sense of where they're going, what direction they're moving in, so that you can kind of end off the Clone Saga in volume, like a sweat. Does Clone Saga really end in volume 5? Am I crazy?
Yeah, it ends with him being given the spider suit, if I'm not mistaken. I kind of, in a comic book shop, I looked at it and kind of saw where it ends off. So that's why I feel like it's the end of the introduction of Ben Reilly, and it ends with him becoming full-on Spider-Man.
Yeah, which, doesn't actually happen until Ben Reilly Volume 2, which is the last issue of Volume 1, which is kind of my problem with how they've packaged it or how they've designed it, because it's just kind of a weird way to go. So I think when you read Volume 5, you'll come out of Volume 5 feeling good. I think you'll go into Volume 5 feeling, man, 4 wasn't very good. I don't know if I want to do this.
I've read all of, like, the worst things about Volume 4, so I'm kind of know, like, not to expect much, which is, I feel, maybe a better way to go into it, because then, hey, that wasn't so bad. You know what I mean?
You know some of the surprises already just because
They're
not a surprise anymore, like about Kane and stuff. One thing I remember that I think people did kind of not like about when they first brought in Ben Reilly and kind of predisposed some people to hating him is that he immediately fights Venom and beats him. And I think a lot of people had problems with this when this first happened because, he is the biggest Spider-Man villain of the time, and yet you introduce a character who's able to beat him in a way that Peter hasn't. And what does that mean about our Peter, that he can't beat him and that he would make deals with him, but then, Ben Reilly's actually able to fight him. Now, part of it's not fair. I mean, Ben Reilly's able to use his spider sense against Venom, which is a huge difference. And again, he's never bonded with the symbiote. So it's just kind of a weird way of trying to show that Ben Reilly is better. At least that's what people read it at the time. Like, even when the symbiote kind of detaches from Brock and tries to bond with Ben, and Ben just kind of, is like, no, get out of my mind, and it seems pretty easy. Like, it's not that hard for him to reject the symbiote, whereas with Peter, we've seen it be a lot harder. So it's just interesting. Another thing about this era that we haven't mentioned as well is that you have, Kane is a mysterious new character, so how do you show that a mysterious new character is dangerous? You have him start offing people left and right. So you have him kill Grim Hunter, who's still a new character at this point. They also have him kill Dr. Octopus, which is a big, big death, kind of done very quickly, and in a very kind of, not a way that lets the good doctor go out with much gravitas. He gets the mark of Kane and he dies. It does push Stunner in an interesting direction, and I love that character, even though, again, she is created in this weird period. And later on, DeFalco would do amazing things in terms of developing her and who she actually was when she wasn't Stunner, which is really interesting.
Yeah, no, it was fun. And I think what I'm looking forward to is once I get through this, I'm looking forward to actually reading the Amazing Spider-Girl series from DeFalco that takes on the premise of, if all of this went through the way it was supposed to, and in a subsequent future, the daughter that they were supposed to have, this is what would become of it. I think that's kind of cool. So I'm looking forward to reading it with that frame of mind. No, even though it's kind of like a what-if reality or an alternate reality, I like the build-up to that extended universe, if you will.
Yeah, the only thing, it's interesting because when I go back to it, I almost forget every time that I picked up What If 105 when it first came out. That was, like, I picked it right off the shelf, and that's the first appearance of Spider-Girl. And I like it, but the artwork always turns me off a little bit, not because it's Friends, but because, again, it's Sienkiewicz.
Interesting. Yeah, I think he's one of those artists who he's almost like an expressionist artist where he's got to do it himself. Whereas if he's taking on someone else, if he's trying to ink someone else's work with his expressions, it kind of takes away from, I don't know, it's just not a balance. And I don't think we mentioned the fact that within these first three volumes of the Clone Saga, there's a big thing happening in Peter and MJ's life where she's expecting a child. We didn't mention right. that, which is a huge monumental moment in, you know, the life of Peter Parker, which I like the character experiencing those things and seeing how they'll adjust their life to that. I don't like that perpetual youth, like he's got to be youth. Nothing major can happen to him because it'll affect her. I like that now he's got to worry about those things. That's always been the thing about Peter Parker that makes you attached to him. You're in high school, you relate. You're in college, you relate. You're dating, you know, all those milestones of life we're going through with him. So that was a fun aspect of this story as well. I think, it gets a bit of a bad rap where a lot of cool things happen.
Oh, for sure. And yeah, it's always going to get that bad rap. Unfortunately, yeah, there is a lot of good stuff. The idea of that pregnancy is again, something different. And, at the time was, pretty exciting, and to see what was going to happen with the character. And you saw the character gradually becoming more pregnant, and they didn't actually tease it out as long as they could have. And, it was cool. And, again, it gave us the Spider-Girl series, which is, again, I probably would say it's interesting. One of my favorite series of all time that I've never finished because when I was younger, I was dumb and I didn't have a lot of money. And when issue 50 came out, I said, well, I'm probably going to not buy any more of this. And I've always regretted it. And I've never really been able to go back. And I probably could find all the issues, but I just was kind of like, well, I missed out. And I kind of left when Pat Olaf did, I believe. But and just now I'm just flipping through it. And like that book is a book where, and this is, it's interesting, when I just talked about What If 105 having that kind of darker vibe to it, I don't think I noticed it when it first came out because that was the first time we saw that universe, and you're kind of used to a kind of darker tone with What If books anyway. They kind of have that more sinister feel to them sometimes, especially in the period of which this book would have been published. And then when you have the Spider-Girl series by Pat Olaf, it's such a lighter, fun tone, and you have him and DeFalco building up this world and really having fun with it and fleshing it out, and it's just this... It's just something to the optimism of the character, and it really feels like a classic Spider-Man book that then when you go back and read that first issue, it feels weird because mm-hmm. it doesn't match the tone of the later, 130 issues of the different various series that you would end up getting with Spider-Girl.
Mm-hmm.
You've never read any of it?
I've never read any of it, but I have the complete collection, Volume 1, on my shelf, especially after I talked to Tom DeFalco a few months ago. I said, I want to read. Because it was one of those series where it's celebrated for the fact of how much the people who did read it loved it. And they didn't cancel it based off of the love of the fans. So when a book has that sort of a legacy, it's like, I got to read this, especially being a Spider-Man fan. So I'm looking forward to reading this character who is essentially the child that was never born in the regular Spider-Man timeline that is initially introduced in the Clone Saga. It'll be fun.
Well, when you eventually finish the Clone Saga epics and you finish playing the Spider-Man video game, I'd love to come back and talk about either Spider-Girl or Untold Tales of Spider-Man because those are both amazing Pat Olaf works, and just an excuse to read a lot more of his work is always appreciated because, again, his pencils on Spider-Girl are so good, and you get such a good sense of the storytelling, the characters, the characterization, like it's all there. There's a youthfulness, there's an energy, there's a real love for what they're doing. It's just so much fun to read, and oftentimes with comics, you don't always get a great deal of fun, and there's so much fun in this book.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And after I have my conversation with James and Mateus in a couple of days as we record this, I'll be able to dig into a lot of the different stuff that I've purchased recently that I'll be able to like read without thinking, oh, I should be reading this instead to prepare for my conversation. So I'm looking forward to getting into all of those books, especially Untold Tales of Spider-Man. That's been on the shelf for way too long. But I think at this point, we'll wrap up our conversation for Epic Saga Volume 1 of the Chatting with Chapman. Will you be back for my next two volumes that I'm going to read, as tough as they might be?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we'll end up doing is we'll very casually talk about 4 and then go in depth on 5. Because, 5 has some much more interesting stories. Again, it's fun and exciting, and There's some stuff which doesn't quite work as well, but for the most part, like there's when you read it, Spectacular Spider-Man 229, like there's you have to imagine if you're you know 11 or 12 year old, it is pretty thrilling. Like you feel like you're on the cusp of something great. It's you know it's exciting. There's so much going into it. You feel like you're there for a turning point in Spider-Man history, and it's really special. And it'll make you want to read you know Ben Reilly epic, and then you'll read that first volume and go, why did I do this? And I'll just tell you, just power on through to volume two. It gets better.
I probably will because I am a sucker, especially for Spider-Man. So volume four is next. Well, thank you so much, Adam, for coming back to the cave and chatting with us. What's next for Comic Shenanigans? Send the, give us a couple plugs for your show.
As we speak, I'm about to record in the next couple of days. I'm going to be speaking with Brian Augustin. He is better. Do you know him?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so he's best known as an editor, but also as a co-writer of Mark Waid's. He was an editor in Flash for years. He's the one who brought Mark Waid onto the book. He's written a lot of different stuff with Mark Waid over the years as well, so I'm excited to chat with him. There's a lot of stuff that he's done that I've really enjoyed, so it'll be exciting to sit down and chat with him and what it's like working with Mark and how they work together and what their collaboration was like, so that's really exciting. We don't have a lot of other interviews kind of on the books yet in terms of schedule, but we're working on a few names that I'm really excited about, so hopefully those eventually get cemented. If those don't come to pass, I'll have a lot more of kind of solo episodes, kind of diving more into the trade paperbacks on my shelf, so you know, either it'll be talking with the creator or doing a dive into history, so I'm not sure which yet.
Awesome. I love those episodes, by the way. They're great.
Thank you. I guess you've kind of started doing those on your own.
I have started them on my own. I'm thinking of the first dive into a recommended reading list for some character that I'm trying to figure out how much of proper direction I can give people. I was thinking maybe Wolverine, but I'm not as like refreshed on all of the Wolverine that I've read because I guess he's back in as far as comics are concerned. I was thinking of doing a Venom because of the movie that came out, but I think of Amazing Spider-Man stories when I think of Venom. I haven't been that well versed in the whole, you know, the Venom series that Michelinie did or the Remender one, but maybe a Wolverine one since he's going to be coming back into the Marvel 616 proper.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm not to invite myself on your show, but I mean, if you can't find a better co-host for a Wolverine one or to do a suggested reading list, I'm usually available.
I'll definitely look you up, believe me. Thank you so much again for being on the show and being generous with your time. I've kept you longer than was originally planned, so thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, dude. Thanks, dude. Appreciate it.